raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair.
The standard brilliant departs, to lighting a hurricane wall. The rescue ship signifies, says what Mitchell in the grand hall.
Americans all, immigrants all, this is the story of how you, the people of the United States, made America. You and your neighbors, your parents and theirs. It is a story of the most spectacular movement of humanity in all recorded time. The movement of millions of men, women and children from other lands to the land they made their own. It is a story of what they endured and accomplished. And it is also the story of what this country did for them. Americans all, immigrants all. As the music suggests, today we tell the story of the Orientals in the United States, particularly the story of the Chinese and Japanese, what they did in building the United States, in agriculture, in science. It was in the 1850s that the Chinese started to come here, lured by stories of California's gold fields.
But prohibitive taxes were soon levied on Chinese gold miners, and they were forced to become the servants of the American miners, and, back in San Francisco, the servants of the miners' wives. So they established themselves as cooks, laundry workers, restaurant and hotel keepers, efficient, faithful, cheerful, doing necessary labor, presenting no problem, so that Governor McDougal of California was moved to say,
I propose that parcels of land should be given to the Chinese who wish to become farmers, for they are among the most worthy of our newly adopted citizens.
Your people are too busy to drain the swamp lands, Your Excellency, but we will drain them and clear them and make them fertile.
I hope that more of your fellow countrymen will come to help you. California needs the work, which you can do.
Thank you, Your Excellency. If there be work for my countrymen to do, they will come.
And there was work to do. Hardly had the first fever for gold subsided when the railroad fever began. Clambering up the Sierras from San Francisco, rail by rail, climbed the tracks of the Central Pacific. Each tie laid down, each rail placed, each spike driven by
Lu Hong of Hankow.
Sam Lan Gao of Lanchao.
Lim Fu Rehul, Changshu of Hong Kong.
Han Fong of Shanghai.
And 25,000 other willing Chinese hands pushing the twin steel ribbon inch by inch, 1,000 feet up for every mile forward, accomplishing one of the most difficult engineering feats in the history of railroading. On May 10, 1869, the Central Pacific met the lines of the Union Pacific at Promontory Point, Utah. And the first transcontinental railroad was completed. And completed, too, was the first great contribution of the Chinese to the development of the United States.
When the job was done, most of the Chinese returned to California. But many of them continued east. In Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, they became tragic pawns in the unwitting game being played between powerful employers and the workers who were then beginning to organize. In the east, the arguments against the Chinese came largely from labor leaders. In the west, as the nation felt the grip of financial panic, agitation against the Chinese broke out and grew violent. Labor, having no legal protection for minimum wages at that time, pressed for the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act, and the measure became a law.
As soon as prosperity returned, cheap labor was needed again.
But we can't get any more Chinese. Who's going to take their place? They're the cheapest labor we ever had.
It was downright stupid to pass that Exclusion Act.
That's right. But it doesn't solve our problem. We've got to have more labor and cheap labor. And there's nothing like an Oriental.
Well, Japanese are Orientals, aren't they?
That's right. Japanese. By golly, we opened up their country to trade, didn't we? Now maybe we can get something in return.
And so Japanese labor was recruited, as Chinese labor had been 30 years before. And like the Chinese, their story was the same. They were used by owners of coal mines in Colorado and Utah to break strikes. Labor resented them. The ranchers of California, Oregon, and Washington resented them. And finally, after a series of negotiations, the entrance of Japanese, like that of the Chinese, was limited almost to the point of exclusion.
But still there are today nearly 75,000 Chinese, nearly 140,000 Japanese in the United States, doing vital, important work in agriculture, industry, in commerce, in science, and in art.
Although thousands of Chinese live in the celebrated, picturesque, and orderly Chinatown of San Francisco, they are also in large colonies in many eastern cities and in the Middle West. The concentration of Japanese is greater on the Pacific coast, and it is there that their typical enterprises in agriculture can be found. Centuries of care and experiment in their miniature gardens and small fields had taught the Japanese to work miracles with the soil. And at Livingston, California, they worked a miracle which to this day seems unbelievable to their neighbors.
Livingston? Why, it was just a bump in the California desert till them Japanese come along. Oh, there had been a town there once, but it just blew away. Settlers couldn't take it, I guess. And no wonder, with that wind piling sand over everything and the desert sucking up every drop of rain. Nope, there wasn't a stick left of Livingston. And one day in 1906, I come riding along, I seen them there.
Howdy, folks. You ain't lost, are you?
No, thank you. Honorable stranger, it's welcome to our miserable village.
Village? Hey, you ain't aiming to live here.
Yes, please. We will build houses, plant many fine gardens and orchards.
Well, I don't want to discourage you, but it just can't be done, not here. You ain't got no shade trees, no water.
Plenty water 2 miles away. We will carry it.
Yeah, but everything you plant will be buried underneath the sand. You can't beat the desert, my friend.
We plant shelter trees to stop the wind.
Ah, shucks, you're just wasting your time to try. Why don't you go somewhere else?
Oh, this land very cheap. We have only little money. We stay here, please.
But folks will just laugh when they hear you're starting a village at Livingston.
Already many laugh. Even Japanese laugh at us. But we stay here.
Well, good luck to you. You'll need it. Come on, Pino.
Much thanks for friendly good wishes. You will come again?
Sure. I'll come again. If you don't blow away. So long. Get up. Well, sir, they almost did blow away. But they stuck at it year after year, almost starving to death. And that fierce sun beating down on them. What plants weren't dried up by the wind and the sun, the grasshoppers at. I thought them Japanese had gone through all the tortures that humans could endure. Then in 1909, I heard that the bank in Frisco that held a second mortgage on their land had closed its doors. So I got on to Pinto and rode out to see my friend Chiwaki. He was in the field, as usual, digging out that everlasting sand.
Welcome to Livingston. To see honorable friend is like cool rain to a posh flower.
Well, I just heard about the bank. I thought maybe Pinto and me could be of some use around here, helping you move.
Move?
Yeah.
We do not move.
You mean you're going to stay here? But look, you ain't got no money, no crops, nothing.
We got patience, my friend. Much strength for hard work.
You can't eat patience, Chiwaki.
We need only little food. Sometimes all one family live many days for only 5 pennies.
Yeah? Well, not while I'm around, they won't. Here, I want you to take this. Oh, it ain't much,
Only as loan. I pay it back, please.
All right, but not till this town gets on its feet. You can consider that my investment in Livingston.
Thank you. But it is good investment. You will see. Someday this desert will bloom like rose, like Bible say. Someday, Livingston will be a beautiful garden.
Well, bloom like a rose, he said. And, mister, you ought to see Livingston now. They planted trees. They brought water. Now they got a cooperative society to market fruit. And a packing house all their own, and the land there is worth $175 an acre. Now they're raising grapes and raisins and figs, and the best almond orchard in all the state, all growing on what we call a desert. Now I call that a miracle, mister.
It's the kind of miracle which the Japanese have repeated many times, as they seem to have a special knack for reclaiming land from the desert, restoring soil which has been exhausted, draining swamplands, all with infinite patience. One Japanese, George Shima, the Potato King, diked island after island in the San Joaquin River Delta, bringing thousands of barren acres under cultivation. Other Japanese also reclaimed much land and paid millions of dollars in land rent for the soil they had saved. Like the Japanese, the Chinese seem to have an aptitude for scientific farming. Across the continent from California, in the northern part of Florida, the Chinese Liu Gim Gong created new varieties of grapefruit, raspberries and tomatoes, and an orange.
This orange, perhaps you would care to taste it for yourself. You see, the pulp is just as firm and juicy as in udder. You like it? Yes, it is sweet. But its great advantage is that it can be stored right here on the tree without spoiling. It does not have to be picked until you want to ship it. Why, some of those have been hanging on that tree for the past 4 years. Frost? No. It does not seem to bother them. It was right after the big freeze of 96. I set to work to grow that orange. Most of the growers around here moved south, but I stayed to see what I could do about it. Across a hot slate with a Mediterranean sweet, and this is the result. America? Well, I just wanted to come. I brought along some silks to sell and worked my way across the country. I am very grateful for all America has given me. I have tried to pay back my debt with this orange. Yes, I suppose it might have made me rich. But in China we have an old saying that he who has money but no friends is not rich. And he who has friends, but no money, is not poor.
The Oriental, both Japanese and Chinese, has often succeeded in business, but the active, rushing method of American industrial and commercial life is not natural to the tradition of the Orient. It is not surprising, therefore, that some of the greatest contributions to these immigrants have been in the sciences where long and patient research, rather than quick action, is needed.
Take the case of one Japanese, Jokichi Takamina.
Born in the year Perry opened Japan to trade.
Represented Japan at the New Orleans Exposition. Married a daughter of a Civil War veteran.
Brought to America a new process in the manufacture of alcohol.
Discovered a substitute for glycerin in printing.
Brought Japanese art and ideas into friendly connection with America. Establishing clubs, planting the Japanese cherry trees in public parks.
And as the climax of a great career, Takamina gave the world the invaluable drug adrenaline. A stimulant, a preventive of bleeding, which revolutionized surgery and has even been used to revive those given up for dead.
And just as Takamina was isolating adrenaline, a fellow countryman of his was coming to America, knocking at the door of opportunity here. Knocking, in fact, at the door of Simon Flexner's office at the University of Pennsylvania. Come in.
Good morning, Dr. Flexner.
Good morning. You wish to see me?
Noguchi traveled many miles to see you.
Oh?
Doctor, not remember?
I remember your face. You're one of the students here?
I'm Noguchi.
Noguchi?
Hideo Noguchi, Tokyo Medical Institute.
Oh, yes, of course. You're the young man who showed me through the institute. I remember. You wanted to come to America one day to study medicine.
At last, they arrive. I'm here.
Well, well, that's fine. And I'm glad to welcome you to the university.
Sir, most kind. feel so glad forget present. Kindly forgive bad manners.
Presents? Are these for me?
Very poor presents. Poor things for position doctor offer me on faculty of university.
A position? Well, there must be some mistake. I made no such offer.
In Tokyo, Noguchi say, want to go to America.
Oh, but I merely agreed that it would be fine if you could go.
You say, write letter, tell what I do in medicine.
Yes, I received that letter.
Was very poor letter?
Oh, on the contrary, it was unusually good.
Then we'll have position, yes?
Well, I'm afraid there's no position open.
Noguchi come 10,000 miles all the way from Japan. Now you say...
Wait, just a moment. Let's try to understand each other. I thought you wanted to come here to study.
But always when study must work too. I'm not rich samurai. I'm poorest farming class in Japan.
I see. And you thought that your letter would arrange everything. I'm sorry, Mr. Noguchi, but I'm afraid I can't help you. You see, there's a rule that no foreigners are to be admitted to our faculty.
No foreigners. But what Noguchi to do?
Perhaps you had better go back.
Back? To Japan? But all my life, want to come to America. Always work hard. Study hard. Teach myself English from grammar book. Sometimes no rice. But do not care. I say, someday we'll go to America. Now, day is here. Cannot go back.
I understand. Well, perhaps with that determination, something can be done about it. Have you enough money to keep you for a while?
No, but we'll work. Hardship. Even if destroy body.
But you are so small and... Well, you'd be limited in the kind of work you can do.
Oh, yes. Doctor, look at left hand. When a tiny child crawl into charcoal fire, burn off fingers. Now have only one hand, but this hand strong, like two. When we shake hands...
Yes, your hand is strong. But a doctor's work requires the greatest skill and delicacy. It's hard enough when he has two hands to work with.
Doctor Wright cannot be surgeon, but can be bacteriologist. See? Can hold test tube between stumps of burned fingers, like this.
A bacteriologist, eh? Yes, I believe you can. Anyone who can overcome the difficulties you've had to contend with.
Then, Noguchi stay?
You certainly may. We'll create a position for you.
So Hideo Noguchi became assistant to Simon Flexner. And when Flexner was made director of the new Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research in New York, Noguchi went along. There, true to his promise, he worked. He made important discoveries about snake venom and discovered a new method of diagnosing syphilis that won him the acclaim of the entire medical world. Simon Flexner was proud of his pupil.
Noguchi, I knew that you were a very unusual person that first day when you walked into my office, but I didn't realize that you were a genius.
Genius? No such thing, genius. Work 3, 4, 5 times harder than anyone else. That genius.
And Noguchi worked. On rabies, on trachoma, on infantile paralysis, and finally on yellow fever. Going to South America, he worked with actual cases until he had discovered the germ that caused the disease and created a serum that prevented it. Then, in September 1927... word came from Dr. Adrian Stokes of the Rockefeller staff in West Africa that he couldn't find Noguchi's germ in the blood of yellow fever patients over there. Stokes' letter also said that he was about to return to America for his vacation. In fact, he was planning to sail on the next boat. Noguchi decided to take Stokes' place.
Dr. Flexner, Noguchi must go to Africa.
Let a younger man go, Noguchi. You're past 50 and far too valuable to send out there.
Doctor, I think... perhaps Noguchi not come back?
Africa guards her secrets well.
Not afraid. Must finish work. Maybe Africa yellow fever different. If wrong, germ not true cause. Dr. Flexner, Noguchi must go.
Dale, you're much too valuable here. Yes, come in.
Pardon me, doctor, but this cablegram just came. I thought it might be important.
Oh, from Africa. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Maybe Stokes stay there for vacation.
Noguchi?
What is it?
Stokes. Stokes is dead.
Dead?
Died of yellow fever at Lagos.
This decided. Noguchi must go.
It's too dangerous.
Doctor, not to worry about Noguchi. Noguchi no yellow fever. We'll win down there or die.
Noguchi went to Africa, and he was about to return to New York for a final check on his researches, was struck down by yellow fever and died. A few days later, his only assistant, Dr. William A. Young, also succumbed. And no one ever knew what Noguchi's last discoveries had been. But the world knew that Stokes, Young, Noguchi, American, Briton, and Japanese had given their lives to save the lives of others.
Men of science, painters, poets have come to the United States from China and Japan. Through their great men, these nations have influenced generations of Americans.
The American painter James McNeill Whistler was deeply influenced by the Japanese Hokusai, and through Whistler, a whole generation of painters.
And the American philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson was deeply influenced by the sages of India and of China, particularly by Confucius.
In unsuspected ways, the Oriental love of decoration and form influences our furniture, our flowers, our manners.
When the world powers imposed an indemnity on China after the Boxer Rebellion, the United States allowed its share to be used to give scholarships to Chinese students. These indemnity students have been the most powerful force in connecting the civilizations of China and the United States.
The Oriental temperament, differing widely from the Western, has elements of nobility all its own, a nobility which pervades even the smallest actions of daily life. Take a tiny incident in the Chinatown of New York. There, as in all the other Chinatowns throughout America, juvenile delinquency is rare. There, within a radius of 8 city blocks, live 8,000 people, and yet the delinquency rate is lower than in any other area of the city. But there was a case back in 1926.
Eddie Wu, age 12. What's the charge, officer?
Truancy, Your Honor. He's been absent from school a week.
Where did you find him?
On a bench down in Battery Park, watching the boats go by.
Mm-hmm. And this man is his father, huh?
Yes, sir.
Can you speak English, Mr. Wu?
I try sincerely, Your Honor.
Do you realize that this is the first Chinese boy I've had in the children's court for 23 years?
I humbly apologize to the United States government for my son's heinous offense. I am completely ashamed.
Why did you run away from school, Eddie?
Please, sir, teacher said that we are all naughty boys in class. She said, you cause me great pain. You are very bad. So, not to make her feel sad and suffer, I didn't go to school.
Well,
Honorable sir, before you pass sentence upon my great criminal of a son, may I make a statement?
What is it?
Upon my own ill-mannered self is the blame for his misdeeds. I have not properly instructed him in the virtues of scholarship. Therefore, kindly sentence me to prison in place of my unknowing son.
You?
Please, sir. I am at fault. I have lost much face.
Well, this is the first time I've ever known a parent to take the blame. They usually blame the teacher.
When a child is bad in Chinatown, it is always the parent who is blamed. A man's first duty to his country, his neighbors, and himself is to train his child properly.
Well, no wonder they're never delinquent.
But I have failed, Honorable Judge. All Chinatown feels this disgrace. You will sentence me?
I won't sentence either of you. Sentence suspended.
Thank you, sir. I assure you that I shall never again disgrace myself.
nor shall my ex-criminal of a son prove himself a bad example to his American neighbor.
Oh, I don't think Eddie meant to play truant.
He must learn to obey the American law. For punishment, he will be forbidden to go anywhere except to the American school from 9 to 3 o'clock and the Chinese school from 4 till 7. I shall take away all his toys and refuse to speak to him for 2 months.
Now, see here, Mr. Wu. Don't you think you're being rather hard on the boy? After all, he didn't do anything really bad.
In Chinatown, Honorable Judge, we punish the first offense and do not wait until the misdeed grows stupendous. Our ancient teacher, Confucius, has said that as the young twig is bent, so the tree will grow.
Wisdom of the Orient, expressed in daily life or in art or science or thoughts of the philosophers, must be the great contribution of the Japanese and the Chinese to American life. Coming here originally as manual workers and doing their work well, they are now limited in numbers, and it is hard for them to enter completely into many phases of American life. But in a country dedicated to freedom of the individual, the Oriental immigrant makes us understand that people with different habits of mind can live harmoniously side by side. We have seen how the patient labor of Chinese and Japanese has reclaimed land from the desert, created new crops, made vital discoveries in medical science, and how the Oriental habit of life, dignified, formal, and humane, can bring something of the highest value to our own lives.
You know, when you go to the theater, you're given a program, a guide to the evening's entertainment. Theater managers consider that printed program a necessary aid to your understanding and enjoyment of the play. And we believe a program is still more important in a radio drama. Americans All, Immigrants All offers you, free of charge, a program that will be a guide to every broadcast of this series. And it's an unusual one, for it has pictures, maps, and charts in the form of a printed booklet. This booklet is what you need to have before your eyes as you listen to these broadcasts, to read after the broadcast is over, and to keep. So get your program, your free booklet, by writing to Americans All, Immigrants All, Washington, D.C. A postcard will do. Remember the address, Americans All, Immigrants All, Washington, D.C. Next Sunday, Americans All, Immigrants All will present Italians in America. Americans All, Immigrants All is a presentation of the United States Department of the Interior Office of Education, with the cooperation of CBS and the Service Bureau for Intercultural Education, with the assistance of the Works Progress Administration. Research by Rachel Davis DuBois and Philip Leonard Green. Script by Gilbert Selders. The original music by Rudolf Schramm was played by the String Ensemble, Leon Goldman conducting. The entire production was under the direction of William N. Robeson. The story... The story of Eddie Wu, the Chinese delinquent, is from Number One Bad Boy by Carl Glick. Permission for its use has been granted through the courtesy of the author, the New York Herald Tribune magazine, This Week, and Reader's Digest. For the free booklet on the achievements of all of America's peoples, write to Americans All, Immigrants All, Washington, D.C. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.